Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lieutenant General James Longstreet, Innovative Military Strategist, The Most Misunderstood Civil War General, by Gregory F. Toretta, narrated by Al Kessel. Introduction. On July 3, 1863, General George Pickett's desperate charge was supposedly the high water mark of the Confederacy on the third day of hard fighting at the Battle of Gettysburg. But it was conspicuously indicative of the total failure of the thinking and planning of the Confederate government and the military men it promoted to carry out its designs. When General Robert E. Lee tendered his resignation to President Jefferson Davis of the Confederacy, he admitted his strategy was defective. Yet Lee, President Davis, and General Thomas Stonewall Jackson are hailed as heroes, while General James Longstreet, who General Lee put in command of this charge, was opposed to the campaign in Pennsylvania and the strategy and tactics involved, is blamed for the failure. Longstreet is one of the most misunderstood figures of the American Civil War. Although he was criticized and maligned by some of his contemporaries and many of his biographers and Civil War historians for his role during and after the war, he had developed a keen insight into the tactics, strategies, and complexities brought about by technological changes in weaponry, logistics, and communications. The American Civil War is considered by many to be the first modern war. It was a war that required a different type of thinking, a leap to encompass the new tactics and strategies needed to fight this brand new warfare. General Longstreet was among a few in the Southern cause who made this leap, others being Generals Joseph E. Johnston and P.G.T. Beauregard, to name a few, and tried new ideas to adapt to rifled muskets and cannon, trench warfare, rail transport and the telegraph, and the concept of total war, in which all civilian-associated resources and infrastructure, railroads, telegraph lines, and food supplies, are considered legitimate targets. Confederate leaders Lee, Jackson, Braxton Bragg, John B. Hood, and President Davis were among those who did not fully grasp the change. On January 8, 1821, James Longstreet was born in the Edgefield District, South Carolina, to James and Marianne Dent Longstreet. James was their third son and fifth child. His grandfather, William Longstreet, took an interest in steam engines and constructed the first steamboat. General Longstreet was an experienced professional soldier by the time the Civil War broke out. He graduated as a brevetted second lieutenant of the infantry on July 1, 1842, from West Point, one of the best engineering schools of the 19th century, and one of the world's top military institutions, where he studied under Dennis Hart Mahan, a brilliant professor of tactics and strategy of the day. West Point is also where he developed a lifelong friendship with Ulysses S. Grant, even though they were subsequent antagonists on many Civil War battlefields. Longstreet served on the frontier with the 4th Infantry at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, from the fall of 1842 to May 1844. He also gained valuable knowledge with Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott in the Mexican conflict, 1846 through 1847, especially the turning movements used by Scott to defeat well-situated Mexican armies. Longstreet fought from beginning to end in the Civil War, as his autobiography, Manassas to Appomattox, indicates. He served with distinction in both the Eastern and Western theaters. His ability to command and direct troops in battle was recognized and brought him to positions of leadership. Longstreet was a pragmatic and methodical general and had a quick grasp of tactics and strategy to use during a battle. He did not smash ahead at the opposing army, but tried to find the key to the situation without needlessly sacrificing his men. He showed able generalship at the battles of Gettysburg and Chickamauga. The Battle of the Wilderness epitomizes his military skill and shows his ability in a crisis. His generalship was superb, and had his advice been listened to, many of the battles could have decidedly been Southern victories. President Lincoln said, "Bring me Longstreet's head on a platter, and the war will be over." Yet this Southern general is not deified like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, men whom he did not idolize, but judged according to their abilities and flaws. There was a monument dedicated to Longstreet on July 3, 1998. An equestrian monument of Longstreet at the Gettysburg National Battlefield Park, 135 years after Gettysburg, by Robert C. Thomas and men and women of the North Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who raised funds to refurbish Longstreet's image. In 2000, a nice statue was erected at his home place, funded by the Denton Hathaway Estate and arranged by the James Longstreet Chapter of the UDC. In truth, Longstreet's name has been blackened as the man who lost the Battle of Gettysburg. After General Lee died on October 12, 1870, an anti-Longstreet faction started a campaign to discredit Longstreet. He was led by Jubal Anderson Early, one-time commander of Lee's Second Corps, Reverend William Nelson Pendleton, Lee's chief of artillery, and J. William Jones, a former chaplain in the 13th Virginia Infantry, who became editor of the Southern Historical Society papers, which carried much influence. They were all Virginians. General Lee had to relieve Jubal Early of command of the Second Corps late in the war, after he was badly defeated in the Shenandoah Valley. Early was the only corps commander Lee had to dismiss. Early had hesitated on July 1st at Gettysburg to take Cemetery and Culp's Hills, which could have been decisive in the battle. Pendleton had been notoriously incompetent and failed in his capacity as artillery chief at Gettysburg. Jones was a Baptist minister and sycophant of the worst type. After the war, the Southern people enshrined Lee. However, there were criticisms of Lee's faults and failures that led to the loss of the battle at Gettysburg. To ingratiate themselves with the Southern people and build up Lee's reputation, the anti-Longstreet faction concocted a tale that Longstreet was not only to blame for losing the Battle of Gettysburg, but also the war itself. As Lee was no longer around to dispute their insinuations, they played fast and loose with the truth. Longstreet was targeted and made a scapegoat because he had opposed the Gettysburg campaign and was critical of Lee's tactics and strategies during the battle and in his writings and comments afterward. He was not a Virginian and had joined the Republican Party, promoting compromise, reconciliation, and improved race relations, which were all abhorrent to the Southern people. Many of Longstreet's biographers believed the lies of the anti-Longstreet faction and bought into this tale of supposed treachery which bolstered Lee's image as a pure and stainless hero that Lee's biographers had popularized. Lee was idolized at Longstreet's expense. There are some profiles of Longstreet, but none have looked at him in the larger framework of the changing tactics and strategies needed to accommodate technological changes, nor have they understood his pragmatic nature. The hope and ambition of this book is to present the generalship of Longstreet in the larger context of the military and political picture of his time, and contemplate the character of the man and his military skill. It focuses on a period from May 1863 through May 1864, which exemplifies Longstreet's strategic and tactical thinking in dealing with the new technological changes. It was during this span that Longstreet made recommendations on how he thought the war should be fought in light of the new technology and the great advantage in manpower and resources the North possessed. The goal is to find the truth, as good historians always strive to do. It offers no opinion as to Longstreet's desires, hopes, dreams, aspirations, or ambitions, which cannot be known. But this treatise merely presents the facts. As an historian, I feel very fortunate that General Longstreet left a valuable source of his views and perspectives in his book, From Manassas to Appomattox, published in 1896, which is a treasure trove of material I gleaned from to enhance my thesis. Longstreet stated his reasons for writing the book in the preface. The spirit in which this work has been conceived, and in which I have conscientiously labored to carry it out, is one of sincerity and fairness. As an actor in and an eyewitness of the events of 1861 through 1865, I have endeavored to perform my humble share of duty in passing the materials of history to those who may give them place in the records of the nation, not of the South nor of the North, but in the history of the United Nation. It is with such magnified view of the responsibility of saying the truth that I have written. In addition, there are extensive writings of participants in the Civil War who communicate to us by means of the written word through time, from which I obtained priceless quotes and insights. I have placed great emphasis on first-hand accounts by these observers. Books by Gilbert Moxley Sorrell, Recollections of a Confederate Staff Officer, Edward Porter Alexander, Military Memoirs of a Confederate, and Armistead Lindsay Long, Memoirs of Robert E. Lee, were especially helpful in corroborating Longstreet's accounts of events in his book. The official records is another font of information, furnishing communications among the parties in the conflict and official reports on military actions. Any entity that ignores technological changes in its strategic planning does so at its own peril. Chapter 1. Technological Changes and Comparison of the Antagonists. Advantage North. The Confederacy had been presumptuous in taking on a war with the North, despite the popular boast, "We can whip them with cornstalks." The North was far superior in material resources and industrial capacity, but few persons foresaw the role this would play in the outcome. One who did was a former Army officer, William Tecumseh Sherman, later a Northern general. Sherman warned a Southern friend, "You are rushing into a war with one of the most powerful, ingeniously mechanical and determined people on the earth right at your door. You are bound to fail." First of all, the northern states enjoyed a great advantage in population, and hence had a larger manpower pool from which to draw recruits. The total population of the country was approximately 30 million souls in 1861. The 23 states that remained in the Union had over 21 million inhabitants, which included immigrants who tended to settle in the North so as not to compete with slave labor. The North had a pool of 4 million able-bodied men to recruit from. The South, on the other hand, had 9 million inhabitants, but this was deceptive because 3,500,000 were black slaves. Since the burden of the war fell upon the 5.5 million white inhabitants, they had to supply the manpower from some 690,000 eligible males. Indeed, some 350,000 men, or half the available men, enlisted in the South in 1861. Thus, the North had four times more eligible recruits from which to draw combatants. The black slaves did help the South indirectly by serving as military laborers and as agricultural laborers, freeing a large number of whites for military service. However, the North recruited 179,000 African Americans into its armed forces. Secondly, the economic potential of the North was far superior to the South's to sustain the war effort. In the North were 81% of the nation's factories, consisting of 110,000 plants, employing 1,170,000 workers, producing products worth $1,621,000,000. and representing a capital investment of $850 million. The South had 20,600 plants, 110,000 workers, producing $155 million worth of products and capitalized at $95 million. The South's factories were, in actuality, shops that relied on hand labor and, for the most part, lacked mechanization. While the North was moving toward mass production and standardization of parts, the South was struggling to create an industrial base. Thirdly, railroad transportation, started in the late 1840s and spreading across the country, greatly favored the North. This new form of transportation would be crucial in sustaining large armies in the field and moving them to vital strategic locations. In 1860, the North had 22,085 miles of railroad track compared to 8,541 miles for the South. This difference belied an even greater disparity. The Northern lines had been built by large companies and had continuous connections between distant points. The Southern lines were built by small concerns, and there were gaps between lines. Many of the South's railroads ran close to land borders or the sea and were vulnerable. The Northern factories could easily replace unusable rolling stock and rails. Not so the South, which had purchased much of its railroad equipment from the North or from the few large Southern ironworks capable of casting rail supplies. The war cut off supplies from the North, and the large Southern factories diverted to producing armaments. Locomotives, rolling stock, and rails, which deteriorated and became unusable, destroyed or damaged by Northern raiders, could not be replaced. The Southern system gradually broke down and reached a state of near collapse by 1864. This situation limited rail movement in space and time for Southern armies and caused severe privation due to food shortages for the military and civilian population. The Confederacy had precipitated a war at a time when the United States reigned as the leading firearms producer in the world, especially in techniques of mass production and standardization of parts. It was in the industrialized North that the majority of the modern arms manufacturing equipment and most of the raw materials were located. This situation was exacerbated at this critical juncture by the transformation of the musket to the rifle as standard weaponry for infantry. The weapons used by American troops up to a decade prior to the Civil War were no different than those used in Napoleon's time. The standard infantry weapon had been the flintlock smoothbore musket. This gun was loaded by tearing open a paper cartridge with one's teeth, and its contents, first the powder, then ball, and finally the paper which served as wadding, were poured down the barrel and driven home with a metal rod. The weapon was fired by a chip of flint on the weapon's cocked hammer, which, when released, created a spark in a shallow pan primed with gunpowder from the paper cartridge. If the powder was wet or even damp, the weapon would not fire. When it did fire, 80% of the time, the ball was unstable in flight and had an extreme range of 250 to 300 yards and very little accuracy at any range. By 1861, the smoothbore musket was made more reliable in all weather conditions, improved by the replacement of the flintlock mechanism with a percussion cap. Tiny cap-like copper casings containing a small amount of explosive, such as fulminate of mercury. The accuracy of the musket could be improved by rifling, spiral grooves scored into the bore. However, forcing a round ball down the lands and grooves of the rifled bore was difficult and time-consuming, slowing the firepower of the infantry. Rifles were impractical for general infantry use. The pattern for the first general-issue rifled shoulder arm for the U.S. Army had been prepared at the U.S. Arsenal at Harper's Ferry in 1841, but suitable ammunition could not be found. This all changed in 1849, when a French Army captain named Claude A. Minier developed an ingenious solution. Meunier developed a bullet made of soft lead, which was elongated with a hollow cone-shaped base. The diameter of the bullet was slightly smaller than the rifle bore, allowing it to slide down easily. The hollow base of the bullet rested on the gunpowder. When the powder was ignited, it caused the soft lead of the bullet to expand into the lands and grooves of the barrel. The spin imparted to the rifle bullet by the grooves in the rifle's bore greatly increased the bullet's accuracy in flight and range. The U.S. Army developed an improved model called the U.S. Rifle Model 1855, and later, the Springfield Model 1861, using the Meunier bullet. These weapons had an extreme range of half a mile or more, an effective range of 200 to 250 yards, and were lethal within 100 yards. This innovation greatly enhanced the defense because, if put in the hands of a marksman in a sheltered position, it was deadly. The rifled muzzleloader gave the entrenched defender a 3-to-1 advantage over offense. Several breech-loading rifles were manufactured in the North, but the old idea was widely held that the percentage of hits were small. The soldiers would waste ammunition if firing too rapidly. The cavalry was the first to receive the best of the breech loaders by the United States Ordnance Department a year or two into the war. It quickly became apparent from experience and common sense that heavy fire was extremely effective. Many believed that had the Federal infantry been armed with breech loaders from the beginning of the conflict, the war would have been over in a year. The tactics of Napoleon were not applicable when considering this new weaponry. Napoleon threw a heavy mass of troops in close-order formations, columns, in an assault timed to break the defenders decisively. Napoleon often prepared for the infantry assault, who used the bayonet at point of impact by sending in highly mobile artillery to soften up the defenders and used cavalry to take out enemy artillery. These tactics were no longer practical with the advent of the rifle. If artillerists exposed themselves at close range, the defenders, armed with rifles, would pick them off before they could do substantial damage. The rifle neutralized cavalry charges, and massed infantry assaults would come under a hail of fire from infantry and the new rifled cannon half a mile from their target, especially in open terrain. The tightly packed mass of attackers would come under such accurate fire that they would be cut to shreds before the attack hit home. If they got close, they would be hit with canister shot, metal cases containing bullets that scatter after leaving the gun, and grape shot, three tiers of cast iron balls arranged generally three in a tier, between four parallel iron discs connected together by a central wrought iron pin, from smoothbore cannon, a very effective anti-personnel weapon. Modification of tactics in the 1850s to take into account the increase in firepower by the substitution of the rifle for the musket was reflected in William J. Hardy's standard textbook, Rifle and Light Infantry Tactics, which advocated the attack be accelerated. However, many of the professional officers made their own adaptation based on common sense. E. Porter Alexander, Chief of Ordnance for the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, says it best in his description of the First Battle of Bull Run. So now, for over 2 hours, these lines of battle fired away at each other, across the front ridge of the plateau, neither one's fire being very murderous, as each fired mostly at random at the other's smoke. That indeed is the case in nearly all battles since long-range guns have come into use. It is rare that hostile lines get so near together and are so exposed to each other's view that men can select their targets. When this does occur, some decisive result is apt to be reached quickly. Fighting rarely consists now in marching directly upon one's enemy and shooting him down at close range. The idea is now a different one. It rather consists in making it rain projectiles all over the enemy's position. As far as possible, while so engaged, one seeks cover from the enemy's fire in return. But the party taking the offensive must necessarily make some advances. The best advance is around the enemy's flanks, where one meets less fire and becomes opposed by smaller numbers. The shortage of rifles in the Confederate Army plagued it throughout the war, and more so in the West than the East. Lack of guns caused the loss of services of 200,000 of the initial 350,000 volunteers, Secretary of War Leroy P. Walker reported in July 1861. The guns that were supplied were of the antiquated smoothbore variety. These were the comparative impressions of E.P. Alexander as he moved from his station in California to join the Confederate ranks. The camps near the principal northern towns were all regiments. Those in the south were mostly of a company each. The arms of the northern troops were generally the long-range rifled muskets. Those of the southern troops were almost universally the old-fashioned smooth-bore muskets. The northern troops were always neatly uniformed in blue, their camps seemed well-equipped, and there was generally some visible show of military discipline about them. The Confederate uniforms were blue, gray, and brown, and sometimes uniforms were lacking. How far some of the Southern leaders were removed from the impact of the new weapon can be shown by the proposal by General Thomas Stonewall Jackson and Governor Joseph E. Brown of Georgia to arm the soldiers with pikes. In Jackson's case, Robert E. Lee actually approved the pikes and ordered the Chief of Ordnance, Josiah Gorgas, to send the pikes. Gorgas knew enough to send muskets instead. Although some of Napoleon's tactics were negated by the new rifle, many of his principles of military arts and science, as interpreted by Baron Antoine Henri Jomini, 1779 through 1869, a Swiss who had served in the French army under Napoleon, in his work, The Traits des Grandes Opérations Militaires, were still relevant on the Civil War battlefield and are used even today. Jomini expounded the use of interior lines, especially when on the strategic or tactical offensive, the concentration of a superior force against an inferior one, and the use of the turning movement to fall on the flank and rear of the enemy, tactically or strategically, to threaten the enemy's communications and forcing him to withdraw or attack to recover his communications. Jomini's concepts were expanded upon by Henry Halleck's Elements of Military Art and Beauregard's Principles and Maxims of the Art of War, both of whom emphasized field fortifications. Dennis Hart Mahan, the charismatic tactical instructor and founder of the Napoleon Club at West Point, taught engineering, tactics, and the art of war from 1830 to 1870. He emphasized Napoleon's strategy and the importance of entrenching and had a great impact on Civil War officers, that is to say, Halleck and Beauregard. Unfortunately for the South, Robert E. Lee was not exposed to his teachings, and Thomas Stonewall Jackson received no benefit from them. Given the great disparity of manpower and resources, and the advent of the new rifled weapons, the Southern strategy needed to be defensive and obtain foreign intervention by Britain and France to overwhelm the Northern states. Barring that, the South had to exhaust the North and make its conquest so costly that the North would find the price not worth the prize. This required the South to conserve manpower and resources, forcing the North to attack Southern forces whenever possible in entrenched positions, or use turning movements and interior lines to thwart Northern advances. E. Porter Alexander, Chief of Ordnance for the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia, gives a vivid description of Confederate arms during the conflict. In its early stages, we had great trouble with the endless variety of arms and calibers in use, scarcely 10% of them being the muzzle-loading rifled musket, caliber 58, which was then the regulation arm for the United States infantry. The old smoothbore musket, caliber 69, made up the bulk of the Confederate armament at the beginning.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?